Hello and welcome back to Big Mouth, the pop culture podcast for the modern time waster. I'm Andrew Harrison, and with me as usual is Sean Pattenden, the athletic and forthright Olivia Newton-John to my sedate and bejumpered Cliff Richard. Hello Sean, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Are you looking forward to seeing hologram Amy Winehouse touring the world later this year?
I've got a feeling that I might not go and see hologram Amy Winehouse touring the world.
What if she's projected outside of a giant R2-D2 like Princess Leia?
But maybe, but it is a very peculiar idea, isn't it? And obviously you could do it with anybody. You could do it with someone actually alive as well.
Well, the gap between hologram person dying and hologram person is getting tighter and tighter, isn't it? Obviously, hologram technology is relatively new. It took a while for Elvis. It took a while for Roy Orbison. Tupac, not that long. Yeah. And Amy Winehouse seems like an indecent...
But which hologram do we get of her? Do we get the one that does sort of roll around a little bit and slurs the words? The one I want to see. I don't want to see the polished, shiny one.
I want to see the quite good one, rather than sad, fan de siècle Amy.
That's where we differ.
Yeah. Apparently all the money's going to go to her foundation.
Oh, well, that's really good.
It is really good. But I hope that we can make sure that hologram Blake Fielder Civil does not come on stage and start ruining things.
Absolutely. Hologram Pete Doherty with the tiny little mice I'd rather not see again as well.
Hologram Pete Doherty with the giant pizza. This is foreshadowing something we're going to be talking about later in the show.
Hold tight,
listeners. We're keeping it compact and bijou this week with just one special guest, but he's a proper special guest. Pete Brown is Britain's best beer writer, the author of Miracle Brew, Hops, Barley, Water, Yeast and the Nature of Beer, also The Apple Orchard, and A Man Walks Into a Pub, plus many another exploration of the planet's best thing apart from pop music. He's also a massive New Order and Cocteau Twins fan and a reader of 2000 AD, so he's basically the person I wish I was. And his new book, Pie Fidelity, in Defence of British Food, is out on 28th of March, the day before Brexit Day. So if you've got any food left, Pete will defend it. Hello, Pete. Welcome back to Big Mouth.
How are we doing?
You had me at Pie Fidelity.
Yes, I'm very pleased with that because this is my 9th book and it's the first time I've come up with a title for one of my own books rather than coming up with something and the publisher going, yeah, what about this instead?
Did you come up with the title first and think, I'm going to write a book around that theme?
No, I came up with the title right at the end in reaction to some dreadful titles from the publisher, people at the publishers, and I was thinking it needed to be a pun, and I came up with Pie Fidelity, because Pies and Prejudice would have been the perfect title for this book.
But it's been done, hasn't it?
But it's been taken, that one.
Yeah, McConey's got it.
Yeah. And damn his eyes.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, what can I do that's very similar to that? And then I, as an ex-ad man, I knew that it was going to be a difficult sell. And I just said, guys, I think it should be a pun-based title. I mean, I'm going to keep thinking. The best I've come up with so far is Pie Fidelity, but I'm going to keep thinking.
Yeah.
I've just kind of buried that kind of smart bomb like in the background. and then, strangely enough, Pete, everyone here really likes that. Really? Oh, wow.
It was just a working title. I just thought we'd give it a go.
If you want to go with that, then yeah, fine.
Well, is it now actually available for pre-order? It should be.
It is. It's on Amazon at the moment. I don't know. It's going to be... It's quite nostalgic about traditional British food. And coming out on the 28th of March, it might end up being nostalgic about food generally. So we'll wait and see.
Or nostalgic about the kind of food you've got to eat right now as you go grubbing around the bins. Again, foreshadowing things we may talk about later. Pete, who would you like to see appearing in a hologram form, deceased pop stars?
Well, the real challenge would be Nick Drake, given that he was never filmed. So,
Put anything on, couldn't
you? I want to see a hologram Nick Drake.
Not hologram Ian Curtis?
I did think hologram Ian Curtis and perhaps hologram Stuart Adamson out of Big Country.
That would be good,
But I did see him quite a few times live. Whereas I thought Nick Drake would be a bit of a challenge.
I'd quite like
for the hologram wizards.
My choice would be hologram Marquis Smith because it would be very easy to animate. It just turns the volume of the musicians down. But what I'd really like to see is hologram Nick Sanderson of Earl Bruce's 60 feet high.
Oh,
60
wow.
feet
That's
high
a great
Nick Sanderson
idea, isn't it?
At Birmingham New Street Station, bestriding the tracks. Performing
with
the SAS
eyeliner,
that would be fitting.
Yeah, that would be beautiful. Anyway, well, Pete, I've been stalking you on Twitter as usual. I noticed you were playing Stump this week.
Yes,
are you a major Stump fan?
I was at the time. They were a major influence on my terrible band at university.
What was your terrible band called?
The Steaming Trousers.
That's very Stump.
I mean, everything about them was as awful as the name. Not least of which was my singing. I tried to sing in a high indie jangly way, and then years later found out I have a really nice bass voice, but I had no idea about that at the time. Stump, we looked at Stump and went, you know, the thing is to make it sound so discordant and dissonant, you've got to be very good musicians to start with. And we went, well, let's just see if we can just sound that bad without being good musicians to start with. And succeeded, but it wasn't quite as good as Stump.
I literally only just realised why a fierce pancake is so cold. I just thought it was a great bit of surrealism, a fierce pancake.
Oh, but
of
course, is there a pun?
No, it's Irish vernacular. It's like fierce means great. So somebody somewhere in their family has made a pancake. So that's a fierce pancake. Well, and there it goes.
There's a lot that's bad about social media at the moment. One of the great things is you put something on like that late Friday night, I'm listening to Stump, and you get some really nice replies back. And one guy who follows me, who's a beer guy, just said, I was working in a bar in Ireland in the early noughties, and I'd never seen a photograph of Stump. And this guy came to the bar and said, what's this you're playing? And I said, it's Stump. And he said, it's awful. Turn it off. Have you got any U2? And it turned out to be Mick Lynch.
God. Well, later in the show, Pete's going to help us assess the new albums from Nena Cherry and St. Vincent. The latter has redone her last one, Mass Seduction, for piano. Yes, that's how prince she is, and she's called it Mass Education. We'll also be looking at the new exhibition by Twitter art sensation Cold War Steve, who makes Banksy look like one of those terrible Banksy knockoffs that you see on the market, of Theresa May flicking the bees and things like that. And we'll be cowering before Apostle, the new historical horror movie from Gareth the Raid Evans. Out now. All this and more after this from Sian.
You can, of course, get a little bit more Big Mouth every week and help us keep on keeping on by backing us on the crowdfunding platform Patreon. The soundproof subterranean chamber where we record this show isn't cheap, so if you can spare a small amount to cover our costs via Patreon, we'd be most grateful. We're asking for the equivalent of the price of a pint, £5 in London money, or $7, because Patreon uses dollars. Pete, when did a pint break the £5 barrier?
It was quite recently. I remember it breaking the £3 barrier about 4 years ago.
I remember it breaking the £1 barrier.
When will it break the £6 barrier, do we think?
Well, it depends. It's a bit like time zones, but going sort of north to south and inwards. It's already in certain pubs in Stoke Newington, well past that. But the average price of a pint, in the UK is still about £4.30.
Okay.
So we're well ahead of the game. We're very advanced in London. But £6. Well, we've got a budget coming up which is going to hike beer duty. So expect it pretty soon. The £6
pint. Drink now, listeners. Pledge us to $7 a month via Patreon, and the coveted extra bit will appear in your inbox as if by magic. This week, among other things, Pete's going to be choosing the appropriate beer for a few of our favourite bands. Search Patreon Big Mouth or go to Big Mouth Facebook page to find that more. All we are saying is buy us a pint.
Now, if your vision of modern Britain is Nigel Farage fly-tipped in a bin on a rural lane while Noel Edmonds and the Queen look on, or Sam Allardyce grinning at a wall of Fray Bentos pie tins aboard Kanye West's private jet, or Celebrity Squares featuring Alan Brazil, Kim Jong-il and Pete Doherty with his enormous breakfast, which we just mentioned, then the Twitter artist Cold War Steve is for you. The account McFadden's Cold War, run by a 40-something public sector worker from Birmingham called Christopher Spencer, depicts modern Britain as a mixture of Nightmare Garden Fate and post-crash Stella Street, studded with fading stars and with EastEnders Steve McFadden cursed to bear witness to it all like Melmoth the Wanderer. Cold War Steve has been called the Brexit Bruegel. John Savage says he's the modern Hogarth or Gilray. And his first exhibition, A Brief History of the World, 1953 to 2018, is on show now at The Social on Little Portland Street here in London. We went along this very morning, we banged on the door, to find out what Cold War Steve is saying about our world. Before we talk about it, let's set the tone with one of Steve's recurring characters. This is Cilla Black from 1965 with Alfie.
What's it all about, Alfie? Is it just for the moment we live? What's it all about when you sort it out, Alfie? Are we meant to take more than we give? Or are we...
One of Cold War Steve's muses, Cilla Black there with Alfie. Now, to be fair, the Cilla he uses is a much more recent one, where she is snapped having refused to vacate a table that somebody else has booked. Her spiteful arrogance was astounding, tweeted the victim, BCO74, on Twitter. Pete, what did we like and dislike about Cold War Steve? What is Cold War Steve saying about our world today now?
I think he's reducing us all to the state which I'm sort of comfortable with. growing up in the north in a working class community, that's kind of the. It reminds me of the. As a kid, did you ever get those rub down transfers?
Oh yeah,
You'd get a panorama of like the Wild West with all the messes and stuff, and you get little Indians and cowboys and horses that you had to transfer down onto it and create your own picture. And he's basically doing that, but with Photoshop. And those backgrounds that you get are the backgrounds of faded northern working class communities, whether it's in the club or out on the street or outside the fast food shop. And to see people like Donald Trump and Kim Jong-il there, they or Kim Jong-un even, some of them look disturbingly kind of appropriate. There's a vacant, bored expression in Donald Trump's face that I've seen in 100 old pubs, working class boozers and working men's clubs and things like that. He looks right at home there as
that,
one of those
that middle
faded...
distance stare.
Yeah,
yeah. Slightly lowered eyes. And,
and then the picture of expression. Scylla, she's kind of looking at the camera with this despair. Her eyes seem to go in, help me. And...
But also kind of frog-like impudence that she's looking at.
I'm better than this.
Yes. And what do we think that Steve McFadden signifies in this? Because this is a world of Dali-esque symbolism, isn't it? You know, the people out there are not just there, they represent things. What do we think Steve McFadden...
I haven't watched EastEnders for 30 years, but what I love about the constancy of Steve McFadden being in it is he's like a Christ-like figure. He's like this modern saint. The suffering that he's been through. Because in a lot of them, he's kind of just looking on with some kind of bewilderment or, what's going on there? But in a lot of them, he's like... He's passed out. He's in hospital gowns. He's bloodied. He's got... I mean, that show has put him through 1,000 torments over the years. Yeah. And I guess that's a metaphor for us. I would imagine that he represents us in this in these scenarios.
So for people who don't know this, if you're not on Twitter, you haven't had these things retweeted at you. They are he makes them on a £3 iPhone app. And he creates these collages of actually beautifully composed cutouts of famous people, you know, sort of shuffled together with the ordinary people of Britain in such a way that you kind of, you know, you can't tell the difference between who's who and who's, you know, is that really Alan Brazil asleep on the meat counter somewhere in a market in the north of England? Sean, but how do you? Well, firstly, do you like the stuff? What do you think about stuff?
Well, I always found it funny the first one or two, but then retweeted on Twitter by and here it is again. I found that on Twitter they seemed interchangeable. And yeah, I've got the joke, and these I felt were easy targets. And there's a lot of Reagan. There's lots of say Kim Jong Il. Donald Trump, and then you've got Ant from Ant and Dec, and you've always got Steve looking on, who's never in the centre. And I felt, yeah, okay, I get the joke. The joke is made. Da, 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 da. But went to see it today, and actually looking at those pictures very closely, although they're not made to look closely at in a way that they're done. It's very crude Photoshop, obviously. Mm. Everyone's got different lighting, and you know that they've been sort of stuck together. I really liked it. Made me laugh out loud, and I thought I wrote down post-Viz meta commentary.
That's cool.
I just thought that there is something here about the interchangeability of a soap opera star and a world leader, and how we are force-fed these images without even realising it. And it's like a very bad dream. When you wake up and you think, oh, my God. They said there's a wonderful picture of a Radio 1 roadshow in the early 80s and Wham are dressed up. And they're out of focus as
in
well.
In their tight shorts phase.
The tight shorts with the shuttlecocks down them phase. And we've got Steve looking on, and it's just and someone else in the...
Greg Wallace in his pants.
Greg Wallace in his pants on stage with them.
Doing a bodybuilder
stance.
And I
thought that's so bizarre and so wonderful. I really warmed to it. And as well, as we all noted, there are masses of pictures. How many pictures are up on this?
Oh, so many.
And that's what... So one of you just... barrage of information is coming at you.
Often when you hear, there's an exhibition of a particular pop culture type artist on, you go and it's eight pictures and you think...
And they're all in a line. They're on the same line.
On a blank wall. And with a little thing next to it that says, you know... Mixed media, 2014, untitled.
Well, these are just loads of them,
It's absolutely packed, and each individual picture. I mean, some of them struck me as the kind of the Sergeant Peppers for a fallen world.
I thought Sergeant Pepper is definitely
without people to admire, just all these sad individuals. But actually, when you look into it, there's quite a lot of pathos in there. I think there's one. Mm. They're not all complicated images, and one of them is Donald Trump looking in a statesmanlike way out of the window of Air Force One. But the face in the window is it's Ant, isn't it? From Ant and Dec, as with his face of despair, as his kind of his career's fallen to pieces, his marriage has fallen to pieces, and this kind of juxtaposition of this, you know, massively egotistical potentate with this guy who's just, you know, Ant is not a superstar. He's kind of been elevated by his own talent and enthusiasm. A man whose world has collapsed, and it's like, you know, what is this saying to Trump? You know, it's Ozymandias. It's like, gaze upon thy works. You will be me one day. Mm. It's almost like seeing the figure of death in the corner of a medieval painting.
Yes.
You know, obviously there's a whole lot of Gin Lane on the go there as well, isn't there?
But I was thinking, because I was trying to be critical about it, because I've loved it since the first time I saw it. And I was trying to take a more critical, objective stance. And I did think, well, it's just one joke. repeated ad nauseum. But from what you're saying, exactly what I felt, it's obviously more than just a joke then.
Yeah.
Because it's not just the joke. It's there's something else that keeps you coming back to it. There's something else that each, the best ones, keep you coming back to them on their own merits.
And the fact that Steve McFadden seems to represent the only sane man in a ruined world. And actually his suffering and his wounds and the fact that he's covered
in
blood.
He's
somebody else who's covered in suffering and wounds, of course, is that he keeps reusing the picture of Nigel Farage and that plane crash.
That's fantastic.
You know, fly tipped at the end of a river or falling out of a pond.
And those are the ones I didn't like so much, as say, the easy targets. Yeah, we know he's a bit of an idiot. David Cameron appears in a lot of them. There's one, though, where there is presumably a North Korean newsreader lady, and he has just photoshopped against the screen that she's by reporting whatever news it is, Rod Hull's death. When it got that random and that bizarre, I really loved them, and I thought there's really something here about, as I say, the interchangeability of what fame is, whether it's power or not.
There's also an amazing image from the Situation Room. Not actually the White House one, but a Situation Room in the 80s, and it's Reagan and the generals pointing at a screen, and the face on the screen is Leslie Grantham when he was photographed in, I believe, what the papers called pleasuring himself.
I remember.
And they're all standing looking with ultimate seriousness at this picture of Leslie Grantham plumbing the depths of human filthiness. And I kind of thought, yes, there is the world difference. There is definitely a lot of Warhol in there, but this is cleverer than Warhol, I think. It's like dismantling the whole...
Well, it kind of turns Famous on 15 Minutes on its head. I think in today's news culture, you get all these people who are in positions of authority and power over us, who have influence over our lives, photographed being stupid in compromising situations, doing idiotic things, and the next day it's forgotten. And to take those images and recycle them and put them in an absurd context and remind us how idiotic these people are by changing the context. Because no, this is a real photograph of them, even if I've cut it out and put it in a working men's club.
Put it in Pontins or something.
Yeah. I think that's quite powerful.
It's very Sleaford Mods. It's very go-kart Mozart. It's very Earl Brutus. Michael Hand, guest on the show, wrote about it for The Economist. He called it furious absurdism. Is this tapping into something real about modern Britain, do we think? Or is it just the emergence of strangeness from this guy, Christopher Taylor's mind?
I feel on this cusp in terms of, like I say, it reminds me when I very first saw Phoenix Nights, that it's like you've dredged some of this from my subconscious. This is reminding me of things that have never happened to me and places I've never been. And as a sort of working class boy who's now a middle class metropolitan media elite person, I really see the pathos of it and the depth of it. I'd be interested to know if some of the people I grew up with like it or not. I suspect they would a lot.
Yeah. And the guy, Chris Taylor, is that his name? Just going to double check. Hang on.
It's Chris something.
Let me start again on this one. Sorry. Chris Spencer. Hang on. And the guy, Chris Spencer, who makes this stuff, has been pretty open about the fact that it actually came out of a personal breakdown and real sort of mental health issues. And he actually found sort of putting the kind of oppressive craziness of the world into these tiny pictures and tweeting them out sort of helped him to deal with this.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? Yeah. I think you said he does it on the bus to work, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Just in the morning.
And sometimes he sneaks off at work and does one in the toilet.
What I'd like to know, did the youth get it, though? Because this is stuff, as we're saying, it's B-Jam, it's markets, it's the jokes that of a certain age you'll remember Britain when it looked really crap in the 70s. Yeah. It's not modern Britain. These aren't... It's car boot fares. It's all that sort of stuff.
It's a memory of the
future. Are they going to get that? Do they think that's funny? I think it's the juxtaposition of those cultures. Just, you know, the delusion in your mind. This is what being... It did remind me that this is what... When I get older, this is what my mind is going to look like. So we're really confused.
I think you're right there. I think it is... It's like the collective breakdown of Britain's mind, which we're going through politically now. The country is in the middle of a protracted nervous breakdown, and as the synapses fail to connect and the neurons fall apart, then you will begin to believe that, you know, Kim Jong-il and Danny Dyer could be propping up the bar
But in that sense, it's very Twitter. I think there is a collective breakdown if you look at Twitter, but I think if you get off Twitter and go for a walk, maybe some of the nation aren't having a collective breakdown.
No, maybe they're not. But then,
but it's very of its medium. This stuff.
It is of its medium, but also the part of the nation that's having the breakdown is the part that's driving the rest of the country into the situation it will be in. Do we think Cold War II is going to be as annoying as Banksy in years to come? Because we look at Banksy now, and it was great in its time, but now...
No, because I think the Banksy message... Sorry, I really hopped in there, didn't I, with my Banksy? Sorry.
Go for it.
I think the Banksy message is so black and white, war's bad. You know, that's the thing. There's no grey. This is really grey. This is... You make of it what you will.
I totally agree. Yeah. Totally agree. Banks is like, oh, the police, they're authoritarian, aren't they? And there's a lot more charm. The joy in this is the juxtapositions. And I do think there's some humility in it. I don't think Cold War Steve feels like he's making big statements that he's somehow superior to everybody. Mm. It feels very democratic in a way. I couldn't explain why, but you don't get the sense that he's being arch or clever. There's actually a love for his subjects in there, I think. Yeah.
There's great sympathy for Steve McFadden from EastEnders, definitely, and several of the others. Well, A Brief History of the World, 1953 to 2018, by Cold War Steve, is on at the most democratic place it could possibly be on at, a bar, a pub. It's on at The Social, number 5 Little Portland Street in London, W1W. It's not an art gallery, it's a boozer, so you can have a drink with the art, which I think would probably enhance. This art in particular will be enhanced by a pint. It's open from 3 o'clock every day, or the Friday lunchtime special from 12:30. Imagine going to the pub on a Friday. Take notes, Tate Modern.
Okay, let's have some music. As is traditional, our guest gets to choose something. Pete Brown, what have you chosen for us today?
So I've chosen Johnny Guitar, calling Gosta Berlin by Snapped Ankles. They've been around for a couple of years now. I saw them at the Green Man Festival this year and felt like I was at the birth of a new religious movement. Basically, Snapped Ankles are like, if the Fall crash landed in a plane in a deep forest, and if that forest was The Vor by B. Catlin, new book, and then 50 years later some explorers found the children of The Fall who'd grown up in this forest, isolated from all contact with the outside world but with electricity, then this is what they would sound like. These guys look like walking bushes on stage. They basically have mic stands with logs tied to them and effects pedals taped to the logs, and then they play the log. The album's called Come Play the Trees, and the first track in the set, they actually are playing trees and then just kind of using the effects pedals to get different sounds out of them. They're insane, they're captivating, they're like the birth of rock and roll, or maybe the future of rock and roll.
Ooh. Fantastic. So this is Snapped Ankles with Johnny Guitar calling Gosta Berlin. Snapped Ankles there with Johnny Guitar calling Gosta Berlin, the choice of Pete Brown, our special guest. They dress as trees, go see them. What beer are Snapped Ankles, would you say, Pete?
Well, I do a beer and music matching show at Green Man, and I when I do it there, I pair it with the beers on the festival because they've got a beer tent full of 70 beers, and the band's playing. When I was there, I matched it with wheat beer because that's very kind of bucolic. If I had a totally free reign, though, this would be a very strong cider.
Okay, fabulous. Right, more music. Nena Cherry has a new album out called Broken Politics, produced by specialist in precarious sounding house music Quartet, and it is a quite far cry from the Buffalo stancing sounds of her early work. St. Vincent has done a Prince, re-recording her last album, Mass Seduction, for solo piano. What are these records like and are they any good? We will find out after some sample tracks. It's Nena Cherry with Natural Skin Deep, St. Vincent with the piano version of Sugar Boy. Cherry and St. Vincent there, which would be an excellent collaboration, but isn't at the moment. But listen, listeners, they might do it. Let's talk about Nena Cherry, Broken Politics first. Lyrically, Broken Politics does very much what it says on the tin. What did you think, Pete Brown?
I really liked it. I was DJing at university when the first Nana Cherry album came out, and it felt like a breath of fresh air then. And this felt like a breath of fresh air now, but age appropriate. You can really sense the kind of reflection and the growth. To me, it reminded me of a more languid, thoughtful Massive Attack. Without being derivative of
them
in any way.
They're pretty languid, aren't they?
Yeah.
Even more languid.
But sort of
yes.
mature and reflecting on those stuff. And I think Fortet's production works so brilliantly with it. I like his tinkly sort of music box production that he does all the time, but sometimes it can be a bit much and a bit too sort of saccharine. And there's a really nice balance here, the way that his production works with her voice. The lyrics are really pertinent, incredibly personal as well as very political. And it's one that I've been sort of, you know, listened to for the show and then put it on again.
Oh, right.
I really enjoyed it.
Which is the sign of something good. She says in the stuff about it that the personal is the political and there is a melding. So we have this stuff where she seems to be really opening up, but there's also stuff about the refugees, gun culture and general breakdown of society. I'm sure there's one of those.
It's a Trump
song, isn't it? I'm going to do a Spotify playlist of anti-Trump songs, which is going to be very large. Did you enjoy that, Nick? Did you think that worked? The melding?
I really did, because, you know, how are you going to talk about politics today? You know, we're so divided. If you try and put anything to party political lines or anything that you actually vote on, whether it's Remain or Brexit or whether it's Republican or Democrat, everything's so divided. And hey, we're all people. but to bring the political back to the personal is, I think, she's not the first person who's done it, but I do think it's what we need at the moment. That this is not driven by some kind of demagoguery or some sort of blind kind of ideology. This is driven by emotion and driven by who you are as a person. And what I like about Nana Cherry is she's still incredibly cool. She always was just one of the coolest people around that you knew. And now she's kind of in her 50s and cool. And I like the way that a lot of this, she's speaking from a position of decades of experience. She's speaking as a middle-aged person because she's seen stuff happen and she's got insight from that. But also presented in a very contemporary way, I think.
Her voice is very different on this. What did you think, Andrew?
I really liked it.
Singing?
I mean, I enjoyed this enormously, a lot more than I thought I was going to, because, I mean, I do like Fortet, but I think I agree with Pete. Sometimes the sort of table with a wobbly leg thing can get a little bit sort
the
of...
The spoon's falling down some
exactly,
stairs.
Exactly, which I'm usually a big fan of, but sometimes can be a little bit much. But I think this is a fantastic matching of styles and sounds. And her voice, as you just said, sounds incredible. She's always had a beautifully characterful voice.
Yeah.
It's just a nice experience in its own right. It is, and it's always clearly, you know, visibly, audibly her. But I think applied to this material, which is more reflective, as Pete says, you know, this is older and wiser. We are kind of entering a golden age now, I think, of grown-up pop music, where to be a grown-up making records no longer means you have to settle down with your acoustic guitar and think about what it's like to, you know, be a father or a mother. You can engage with the world around you. At a basic sensory level, I thought it was great, and I wanted to keep playing it. There's a few sort of little interpolations of mobile phone conversations and stuff.
I was going to add, there's lots of bits where they've kept in the edit. Lots of asides and sort of that. So there's mobile phones.
Yeah, you get the sort of chatting and sort of muttering to herself.
Yeah, pre-singing.
Yeah, a couple of studio bits.
After, yes.
So you get a strong...
It's a very Fortet thing.
It's a very Fortet thing that you use, that you sort of treat the unity of the sound as worthy of attention.
Yes, I wrote field recording down, field recording. Like little swatch.
Well, it's much more of a street recording than them, isn't it?
Of course,
although they did record it in Woodstock. Apparently, actual Woodstock. In America, Woodstock, not Woodstock over here. So maybe it actually is a field, a field recording, an actual field. So I was really persuaded by this and really enjoyed it. And I thought it's quite an achievement, actually. I think she's, it's often for women artists, and particularly women artists in the dance music background world, they tend to be thought of as the singer.
Everyone tinkers with the music stuff
While the men do the real music. And I don't. I think she sort of flattens that whole idea, because this is a complete work about her place in the world and her way of looking at it from her vantage point. And the cover, I think, is quite instructive, because she seems to be on the corner of an ordinary road.
Describe the cover.
Well, she seems to be on the corner of an ordinary road. It's somewhere in West London.
I think it's Westbourne Grove.
Yeah, Westbourne Grove, something like that. And she's got this amazing kind of billowing frock thing on. She's just materialised like a superhero. She's just burst into appearance on the corner. But it's in an ordinary place. It's not. She's not kind of making herself into some kind of titan. She's like, this is the street corner of a place...
jumping.
And I'm appearing, yes. Yes. And you might, and it's a place where you might live. And that's what I, that is the vantage point. Which
yes, I really like that. There's no diva here. There's no, gauze or special lighting. I have just appeared. And, you know, it's like, no, I'm nearby. I'm going to come and knock round, knock on your door and borrow some sugar. And also tell you, I'm a bit worried about Calais.
A little bit in that, like that amazing Roisin Murphy artwork a few years ago, where she was in very, very, very ordinary, boring places like, you know, markets and bus stops, wearing absurdist, mad fashion, which, you know, her clothes made her look like, you know, she had a Rove stage lights above her head as if she was actually walking around on her own portable stage. So it's a little bit like that, the placing of the extraordinary and the ordinary.
But she looks very powerful as well. This is, it's a very, I can't remember who designed the cover, it's someone very famous, isn't it? But she looks, it's not a kind of traditional cliched power stance. She's not doing the kind of standing with your legs akimbo or anything.
She's not
like
doing a Sajid David.
No, but she's but she's just like, whoa, that's you have just manifested and you demand my attention.
Yes, well manifested, Nana.
I thought that was lovely. Now, the collaboration with 3D of Massive Attack is Kong. And it's about the refugee camps in Calais, which I only read about afterwards. And I kind of listened to it. The very first listen, I thought, "That's it could be about a few different things." Is it, you know, that you write about refugee camps in Calais, you've really not got to push that war is stupid thing. You've got to be subtle about it. And does that work? Is she subtle enough about the politics?
Well, I'd miss that.
Or shouldn't she be?
I'd miss that was a subject as well,
right?
Which means that if you're trying to be subtle about politics, it's the it's the right thing to do. It's going to be interesting to see how it beds in, because given that I've already said it demands repeated listening, what I would imagine will happen is that some of those messages will come out and unfold over time, which is what happens on any great album, really.
There's also little interpolations. Oh, yes, the Naina singing into her mobile phone, chatting and everything else. There was one point, though, when I was hearing all this stuff. And see, you're not bombarded with music, but we've got that production where there's something filling the sound all the time. But I thought she sounded quite lonely on it. I thought she sounded a lone voice. Mm. And there aren't backing singers and there aren't hand claps and there isn't a sax solo. There's sometimes she's singing the backing to it. And
there's no sense of a band either. You can't hear musicians.
No. It seemed very much, this is my record. And, you know, a couple of collaborations aside, because they're the usual collaborators, no one knew, it seems, that she's worked with. It seems like this is my personal statement. Actually, I'm quite brave to be standing here and I'm just going to say it like it is. And I thought that was really lovely about it.
At one point, on my favourite track, at one point she says, I am Naina. My name is Naina. It is the 10th of March. And it is just, it's such a quiet place of stillness. And it's
That's her advert for Match.com, I felt. Charming, I thought. Let's move on. Let's move on to St Vincent's Mass Education, which is her pun on the original album, Mass Seduction. See, Pete, were you a fan of the original record? And are you a St Vincent fan overall?
She's not caught my listening, but again, I saw her play a festival a couple of years ago and it was so powerful. We just had to go and sit down afterwards and just go. My wife was going, shut up. I just need to process that, because that was just one of the most spectacular things I've ever seen. And a lot of the songs off the Mass Seduction album were some of the highlights of that set. Absolutely stunning. So that was kind of really my sort of most recent point of reference with St Vincent. I listened to the piano album and then went straight back and listened to the Mass Seduction album and found it really interesting, because I think, you know, quite deliberately with a record like this, it's all about kind of, we're going to strip away all the pyrotechnics, and this is about the voice, it's about the songwriting, it's about the artistic vision. And I thought on a song-by-song basis, it was quite interesting what worked and what didn't work. I found the title track, Mass Seduction, really annoyed me when it was the stripped back piano version. I think when you listen to the original, it's a banger that Prince would have been proud of. You know, it would have been honoured to have written. And it's just annoying when it's there on the piano, I'm afraid. Whereas if you get something like Sugar Boy, which again on the original album, it's another great disco banger, kind of like high energy 80s floor stomper. And then she does it solo on the piano and it's Gershwin. And it's just like, oh my God, that's two completely different interpretations of exactly the same melody. And I love them both. So I thought it was really, I think on the whole, it's a successful album. I think it's a fascinating thing to just kind of go back between the two versions of anything like this and see what works and what doesn't.
Zigzag between them.
Yeah.
Andrew, you're a massive St Vincent fan.
That was my album of the year last year. I thought it was incredible. I absolutely played it. I do totally love her as well as the music. I think
the enormous bangers that she does, and very glossily produced work with something so stripped down. Do we need it?
Well, I think she is an amazing songwriter and an amazing singer, as well as somebody who clearly has a good strategic idea of what she wants to be in pop. She wants to be a big thing. She wants to make a big... That last album, Mass Seduction, was about making a huge statement and saying, look at me, I'm a huge thing on the landscape. My favourite track on it, however, is Happy Birthday Johnny, which is itself just a little stripped-down piano thing. Mm. And the version here is almost exactly the same. There's very little, but it's such a piercingly heartbreaking song about an old friend of hers, I think may even be a family member, who is basically living on the streets, addicted to God knows what. And it's just about her endless guilt about having left this guy and being unable to rescue him. And it's an absolute heartbreaker. And to me, that's a little bit of connecting tissue between the two. I basically agree with Pete. You know, the things that were huge productions on Mass Seduction don't work as well when stripped down to just her playing the bass line, you know, with her left hand. I do like the fact that you get a lot more presence of her voice, because I think she's a singular pop presence. I mean, basically, you know, Mass Seduction was a record about sex and mania and being driven to the edge of your ability to hang on to yourself by both, you know, the demands on your personal relationships and the pressure of the outside world. And being brought closer to the voice that's singing those words, I think, is really interesting.
Right.
It's not as good as the original, obviously, because the original was conceived as this gigantic sort of epic kind of, you know, battle cruiser of state-of-the-art pop.
I mean, this is essentially unplugged, isn't it? But with a piano. Are there any other artists we think who should be furrowing this path and stripping down what seem to be glorious pop classics?
It's become a bit of a cliche, hasn't it? To sort of go, and this is me, you know. And I sort of think, if anything, I much prefer it when we go in the other direction, and when the sort of heartfelt ukulele acoustic guitar thing is you know, taken over by, you know, the almighty, and they make a big banger out of it. You know, I'd much rather have that. I mean, the most appalling war crime in pop in recent years was taking Robin's Dancing on My Own and turning it into this bloodless little acoustic whinge-a-thon, which missed the point of the tune entirely. And I think I'm willing to let St. Vincent do it because of her massive talent.
Yeah,
I think we have had quite enough of it elsewhere, though. What people really need to do is do roots reggae versions of things. You do a roots reggae version of something, it's always brilliant. You know, like when Little Roy did the full Nirvana catalogue in the reggae style. Yes. Amazing.
So the same bass line and the same beat. Nice.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. It is the test of a good song. Can you do it roots reggae style, and can you do it country style? If you can do it country style, it's probably a good song.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Not entirely sure I want to hear St. Vincent roots reggae style.
Should she do it on any of her other albums, do you think? The piano version of them all?
No.
Okay, no. All right. Shall we move swiftly on?
Let's move swiftly on. If you like Big Mouth, you might enjoy another podcast that we produce, Be There with Dali Loudspeakers. Dali make high-end speakers with exquisite sound reproduction and the best in Danish design. They are truly beautiful things, and they're built to get you closer to the music. The Be There podcast tells the stories behind the songs, and there's a new episode out right now. You can find it on your favourite podcast app. Just search Be There with Dali. Here's an excerpt from the new episode. This is Big Mouth regular David Hepworth talking about his book Uncommon People, The Rise and Fall of the Rockstars, in which he argues that rockstars themselves are now a part of history. What made you think that the age of the rock star had passed? Was there a thing?
I tell you, the thing was that I kept hearing, every time I turned on a radio or read a newspaper, people were being referred to as rock stars who were not rock stars. I'm talking about politician rock stars, Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, probably the first rock star president. And, you know, you could be a film director rock star. And it struck me that the idea of the rock star is a very, very powerful idea. It hangs around in our heads, even though actual examples of it, of that genus, have kind of passed. And pretty much like the cowboy, as I said with the cowboy, you know, the cowboys stopped existing at the point that cowboys started being celebrated in Hollywood films. Mm. You know, they weren't there anymore. And, you know, that was my view about rock stars, that you could no longer behave in the way that a rock star traditionally behaved. You're simply not allowed to anymore, you know, because these people were absolutely larger than life, and they made music that was a reflection of their personality, and their personality was a reflection of their music, and it absolutely worked perfectly together. Now we live in far more careful times. We live in far more censorious times. You know, one of the points is I make in the book is that if you went around nowadays behaving in the way that Jimmy Page or David Bowie behaved in 1972, you'd be dragged before the court of public opinion.
And possibly the court of the courts.
The court, absolutely. And forced to apologise.
Yeah. You
know, now, what is the one characteristic of rock stars? They never apologise.
A bit of the new episode of Be There with Dali there. Get it on your favourite podcast app. now, who wants to be so horrified about what goes on in the countryside that they never ever leave their house ever again. Apostle is the new movie by Gareth Evans, who wrote and directed The Raid, that one where they all went running up a skyscraper in, where is it, Malaysia?
Yeah.
It depicts strange goings-on in an isolated island religious community in the early 20th century. Dan Stevens from Downton Abbey plays a man investigating the disappearance of his sister. Michael Sheen is the charismatic cult leader. And rather than coming out in cinemas, it's a Netflix release. Does Apostle make the most of the Netflix format? And should you watch it? Here's a taster.
Thomas, your sister, she's gone. These people, they're blasphemers. A cult, a disease. Bring her home.
Name?
Thomas Richardson.
I dream of a world in which each waking day we rise equal.
This island,
it's our paradise.
We have an intruder on our land. We have to find him.
Your eyes. They've seen things. Who are you?
He shall be cleansed according to the edict of this land.
The promise of the divine is but an illusion.
God is pain. God is suffering.
Beware false prophets which come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravening wolves.
Let us begin.
Lock Lang in there. Gareth Evans' new movie, Apostle, starring Dan Stevens, of either Downton Abbey fame, if you're me, Marvel's Legion fame, which is much better. So the setup is, it's 1905, the daughter of a well-to-do businessman has disappeared into the hands of a weird Scottish, or is it possibly Welsh, cult, never quite defined. Dan Stevens has to go and find her, and then weird stuff, both criminal and spooky, begins. And it's a kind of paramilitary religious police as well. It's the Victorian Wicker Man plus rural Peaky Blinders. Pete, what did you think? Without too many spoilers, Pete, what did you think of Apostle?
Yeah, thanks for making me watch that, mate. Now, I tend not to watch too many horror films. If I did, I would have been absolutely blown away by this one. I'm really hesitant to say too much about it because I don't want to spoil it for anyone who's a fan of the genre, because I think it will blow their minds and I think it will be a landmark of the genre in 20, 30 years' time, just the way The Wicker Man is still held up today. I hated it on a personal level because it's just not my style. Yeah. But that just shows how good it is. It twists and turns, shocks, thrills, spills. I was going to say, swimming in gore at one point. That's literally true. And just everything you want from a horror film, if you like horror films.
Well, it's interesting. So it's going to be a highlight of the genre, because my question to people: which genre? Because again, without too many spoilers, this is a film which lurches back and forth quite a lot.
It does, and it's. It starts off, anything, tense thriller, tense period thriller. And by the way, the period stuff is amazing. I love the dialogue and the costumes and the sense that you are in 1905 or whenever it's meant to be. Yeah. That never lets up. It's just so well produced. And then it goes bonkers and you're into a completely different film.
Yeah, I think going bonkers doesn't count as a spoiler. I think that's allowed. Sean, what did you think?
Because
you
were... The last horror I saw was Mother, which I think is indeed for this podcast, where everything goes bonkers at TM. I don't know. I think it's three films in one, actually. There's a first, third, second and third. I watched it with my dad, which was an interesting experience. And both, by the end of it, just look on our faces of, can it end now? Yeah. We've been through the mill. I mean, not as much of the characters in there. Yeah. I wanted Ben Wheatley who is very good at producing horror films, to have directed it. It just didn't quite gel. The Wicker Man, I love The Wicker Man, but I felt some of the themes on this didn't quite... how pretentious do I sound? But some of the things didn't quite work. The stuff about his sister, the finding, they could be made more more of it rather than keeping getting the plot going on. Yeah. I thought that maybe it had been originated as a series and then got made into a film because there was so many different avenues you could have gone down.
Yeah, I think when you say, that's interesting you say Ben Wheatley, because what I found missing from this, and it's very difficult to talk about it without giving,
to say nothing.
Without describing what the supernatural, because there is a supernatural element, without describing that in some detail, it's very hard to kind of get to the meat hem of what this film is about. But I think what I found missing about it is in Ben Wheatley's films, there is a meaning to the subtext. He has got something to say about the world around us. And this, to me, didn't have much to say apart from within its own little sandbox of shocks, gore, and the emergent supernatural.
One thing I was talking about with my dad after was that the central character is introduced and he is given a mission. So the very traditional. He's introduced to someone. You're not sure if he's good or bad. Mm. I thought there's a really nice bit of grey there where we have Dan Stevens. He has these piercing blue eyes, which are really spooky, and they're used to well effect in this film. And you're not sure whether he's going to go somewhere and cause trouble. But by the end, he is a good character. He is put upon. He has to face evil. And I thought that's one of the problems I had, is I wanted that grey character, someone who may have gone down a different path to exist. And it became Disney in the end of who was good and bad. But that is horror. So, I mean...
Yeah, very few of the characters actually undergo any change whatsoever, do they? I'm a big fan of Dan Stevens. Sure, he's a massive scenery chewer, particularly in Legion, where he has to do this because he's literally a man with dozens of personalities and also cursed with the most powerful mutant brain on the face of the earth, because it's a Marvel thing. So there's a lot of scenery chewing involved there. Yeah. And I think it's allowed here as well because the environment, the whole kind of context of the film is so heightened.
Yes. There's one bit, I'm sorry, in the first half an hour, he has about five lines or something. I mean, he doesn't speak so much, and that's when he's more interesting character. They've given him nothing to do but to look around and discover, and I thought that was really interesting.
But I'd like to stick up for Michael Sheen as well, because he's the cult leader.
Yeah.
And like any good cult leader should be, he's a great mix of charm, charisma and menace and malevolence. And maybe that character doesn't go too far in the film, but in terms of change, but he does play both sides. He's not entirely good and he's not entirely evil. I think he's quite compelling and believable in that role.
Yeah. There are points where he will just give a look, you know, to the side, or you know, just slightly off camera, of should I really be doing this? I thought he played it really well.
But unfortunately, I think a lot of the supporting...
he shouldn't have really been doing any of that at all.
No,
unfortunately, a lot of the supporting characters and roles are nowhere near as rich as his. I mean,
that terrible scene where man just goes, "Yes, I did this," because but to the women who are just chained up. The female roles are terrible.
Yeah, it does...
I would need to say they're all done too. None of them are doing.
Well, there's quite a lot of brutalising of people, and particularly brutalising of the ladies because on this one. And I know that's kind of core
to
horror.
Have no agency in this film. That annoyed me.
Well, what I found, I mean, I've got to say, I didn't like it. I didn't enjoy it. I found the brutality kind of contextless, and the supernatural aspect of it, when it's revealed, I thought, I've seen this a billion times before, and I understand where this would fit into a kind of paganistic way of looking at the world. Well, the thing that concerned me most was that it's like Gareth Evans seems to want to... He loves his cool shots. He loves his astonishing images. They don't seem to mean anything. They're there to make your jaw drop, but they don't serve any kind of narrative function.
Nice upside down shots and some sideways shots that I thought were really interesting.
He loves to canter camera.
Yeah, I really
He's
like
canting
that.
His camera all over the shot.
I think it's. I think it's. I think I don't disagree, but I think thematically it's very strong, and I do think it's this whole area. It's interesting, sort of linking it back to the Wicker Man, and nowadays, because it is. It is about belief. It's about spiritual belief. And there's different strands of that. And I do feel like we feel bereft and lost at the moment. Yeah. And it's just kind of prodding that little theme a little bit.
My main reaction to it was, I don't mind being brutalised if there's something worthwhile to come out of the ordeal at the end. It's the same as with Mother. I really detested
Mother.
Because I felt I just had a bucket of offal dumped over my head for no reason whatsoever. It had, you know, to say the most trite and banal thing you could possibly say that can be depicted in, you know, a news single panel newspaper cartoon, not 2 hours of me having, you know, blood squirted to me face. And at the end of this, I thought at the end of this, I was like, and why have you put me through this, Mill? for what? And I didn't really feel like it had the profundities up its sleeve that I think it thinks it has.
Hmm.
That was my issue with it. But hey, there's a whole lot of blood and craziness if you like that kind of thing. And the costumes are amazing.
Mm.
And the spooky bit, which we shouldn't really discuss in too much detail.
Let's not. You know. Just watch it. I really enjoyed that. I mean, say the first half or something, I just enjoyed it.
Yeah. But don't have a rare steak or fried liver before. And
children,
or
not allowed. Do not.
Yeah. Don't have children in the room.
Show this near your child.
And I mean, I'll watch large parts of it through knotted fingers, but there you go. Finally, it's just one guest week, so Sian gets to choose a tune as well. Sian, what have you brought in to show and tell the listeners?
I have showed and tell Kurt Vile with Yeah Bones.
Mm-hmm. And what's that then?
Well, I'm not a massive Kurt Vile fan. I believe he releases so many records I kind of lose count. But now and then I sort of dip into the world of someone deeply inspired by country music with a very original voice and a very original way of songwriting. Although he gets lumped in with the indie thing, and I don't think that's totally fair. I just happened to see the new album was out, gave it a listen. I love it, can't stop listening to it. Yeah, Bones is fantastic. I was playing it to some 13-year-olds. Listen to this, this is proper music, as they tried to play Fortnite. So I just a really enjoyable record, and let's take him out of the indie canon and just put him in pop.
Okay, well, let's have a listen then. This is Kurt Vile with Yeah Bones.
When nobody calls you on the phone, don't break your bones over it. You'll only leave yourself lonesome to show for it. When nobody calls you on the phone, don't break your bones. Dying dead in the black sea of tears over me.
Kurt Vile with Yeah Bones, as chosen by me, bringing us to the end of Big Mouth and it's closing time, chatter time. Yeah. What will we be talking about over a blue wicked? Is it pronounced
wicked? It's pronounced wicked. Wicked. WKD.
Right. What will we be talking about over a blue WKD on the bonnet of a burnt-out Cortina with Cilla Black, Kim Jong-il, Brian Harvey and Cold War Steve this weekend? Pete Brown, what have you brought in as your closing time chatter?
I'm trying to wean myself off reading newspapers, but something that caught my attention yesterday was the coven of witches that are convening in New York to put a hex on Brett Kavanaugh.
Tell us more.
Actual witches.
Actual witches doing an actual spell on Brett Kavanaugh. And the main reason they're doing it is because they know how much it's going to upset right-wing Republicans. So Fox are going, this is an outrage, this is satanic, you're offending good Christian morals. And it's like, yeah, that's the point, mate.
We're witches.
We're doing it entirely to create that reaction in you. And I love the fact, I was reading interviews with people who are doing it, and they're saying, when you get to a point where people are stealing elections and breaking down democracy and trampling over women's rights and all the rest of it, and do you expect the left to carry on playing nice? God no, we're gonna play nasty. And I love the beautiful kind of situationism aspect of it, and that when the left plays nasty, there's a good thick stream of humour in it.
I like the idea that if you've been told over and over again you're serving satanic purposes, to turn and say, well, all right then, yes. Wilson. Do you think that observant Christian Brett Kavanaugh really is going to actually secretly believe that this is real?
Let's hope so. Let's hope so.
I'm hoping it's going to be a new Netflix series as well next year.
Coven of Witches.
Yeah, absolutely.
Fantastic. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Andrew, what's your closing time chatter?
Well, my closing time chatter also features a Brett, but not Brett Kavanaugh. Ooh. It features Brett from Suede, and it is there's a Suede documentary coming out in a couple of weeks' time on Sky Arts called The Insatiable Ones. However, it's been preempted by a fake Suede documentary called The Insatiables, and it's really, really funny.
Can you watch it on?
You can watch it on YouTube. Just
nice.
and it is so funny that Matt Osman from Suede has tweeted it himself, saying this is really, really funny. It basically is in the style of the Matt Lucas, David Walliams pop stories of yore.
Yeah.
It tells the story of Suede in grand mockery.
Yeah.
And
great pomp,
I hope. Pomp. And the guy who's made it can actually do a reasonable Suede impersonation with a kind of a high voice, but also the cadences and the chords.
Does the music as well as the characters. Yeah,
made up songs.
Oh, brilliant.
Full of great, clever little, very, very funny gags, it's done on the cheap, so it uses old press pictures of Suede and this kind of thing. But there'll be a picture of Suede's sort of press picture from about 5 years ago. And he's changed Matt Osman to be about 17 feet tall and made no comment on it whatsoever. Every time Suede are mentioned, they're the logo comes up, but it's the Pulp logo, or it's the Oasis logo, wonderful. But it says Suede. It's like the Oasis logo. It says, oh, the Blur logo, but cruelest of all, Suede looking like the Blur logo. So this is somebody who knows their indie pop inside out, really, really inside out. And the vocal impersonations of Brett are very funny. The you know, and he really knows his Suede lore as well, because he's making, you know, saying, you know, Bernard Butler finally found somebody he could collaborate with himself on his solo record, this kind of thing. And it's like, you clearly know and like this band enough to be able to make the jokes. So we'll stick it on the Facebook page and we'll tweet it as well. But it's called The Insatiables and it's YouTube. And if you know anything at all about Suede, you will laugh your head off.
Marvellous. Well, my closing time chatter is that I went to the Barbican recently and saw an art show called from Francis Up Richard called Wet Wang Slack. Try and say that after you've had a few beers. I enjoyed the show immensely, but the Barbican's barbicanification of itself was driving me mad. There's an auto-canonisation of art spaces and music spaces and culture spaces, I will explain in a moment. All it was selling was postcards of the Barbican and Brutalist books with the Barbican on the cover, and everything was Barbican based. I couldn't even find a postcard of the exhibition I had been to, and I thought, this is eating itself. This really is. It's like going to the Tate and just looking at postcards of the Tate. We won't bother about the art. We will just, as I say, put ourselves in the canon. And I felt that someone had just gone marketing crazy, and I hope that this isn't the way. You go and see a gig and you have to go through a wall of pictures about the venue and how nothing about what you're going to see there and what's being shown there. And I thought the onus and the focus was really off there, and it made me feel. And then you can buy a teapot that's been designed by someone in Scandinavia, and it's just, this is too much.
I went to that exhibition. I thought the exhibition was amazing.
And this one,
yes,
it's fantastic, isn't it?
Wet Wang Slack.
We must up it.
Wet Wang Slack.
Yes,
And it's amazing, and there's incredible sort of sculptures of miniature, sort of strange and disturbing dwarf people, and a fantastic set of hats. Yes. And we're walked through the entire panoply of consumerism, aren't we? From statues to shop to museum.
Yes,
to,
and then, in the British Museum part of it.
But I actually quite like the fact that you couldn't buy any merch. You had to experience the thing, and when you've experienced it, you couldn't take anything away.
I suppose, but I was just very surprised, and I felt for the artist that all the Barbican were trying to do was sell the Barbican. And I didn't want to buy the Barbican. I was in it, it was fine. So I was enjoying it at the moment.
You didn't want to buy a Brutalist salt and pepper set then?
Yeah, and it says, take a bit of the Barbican home with you, but I don't want to.
No. Yes.
I just enjoyed the exhibition anyway. I would just say, hang on, everyone, let's curate what we're actually trying to curate, not the space itself, man.
Stop. Curators keep curating. Anyway, that's the end of the show. Thank you, Pete Brown, for coming in. Always welcome on the show.
Pleasure.
What's your next exciting pop music thing? Are you going to go and see anything exciting?
I'm going to see, oh God, it's a sign of age. Mm-hmm. Most of our pop culture experience is in our past now. I'm going to see the House of Love 30th anniversary show of their first album.
Amazing.
At the Roundhouse on the 10th of November.
Fantastic.
So I'm looking forward to it. I saw the House of Love a few years ago playing Latitude, and I thought, guys, if you could play like this when you brought this album out, you'd have been the biggest band in the world, like you always wanted to be.
Well,
so it should be good.
That sounds good. Pete's going to stick around for the extra bit and tell us which bands match which beers. You can get it by backing us on Patreon. So just search Patreon Romaniacs on the internet, or you can find it on our Facebook page. Dear listeners, thanks for listening. Thanks, Sean, for backing me up. And thanks to Sophie Black for producing. And we will see you all next week.